The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Steve King, the CEO of Black Swan Data. Thanks, Steve. Really appreciate you taking the time, mate.
Thanks, Andy.
It's good to have you on. I'm really fascinated by, I'm fascinated by yourself, actually, and also what's been going on over there at Black Swan Data. It's just been such an incredible rise, and I was made aware of you not through your CNBC interview, actually, which we were just talking about before we started recording, which I'm sure we'll pick up in the future. But just through the various accreditations and accolades that the company had received, and I'll be honest, I didn't really kind of pursue and see what kind of all the hype was about. And then I started doing some reading, obviously knowing that we had this podcast coming up, and it's actually really fascinating some of the things that you're working on. So I'm really feel fortunate that I've got you on today, so I can bombard you with questions. It should be great.
Yeah, it was very kind. Thank you. You're probably a bit disappointed when you actually get to know me, but
no, I don't know about that. It's been fascinating. And I think that the world of kind of data in general has just been like super fascinating. We've certainly covered like a little bit on the show, but some of the things that like you guys have been addressing over at Black Swan, it seems as though you feel as though you really have a vision and a grasp on, you know, what some of the issues were with the way that companies were looking at data and how they were kind of propositioning data and trying to actually extract value out of data. I think it's been something that, you know, we've had, you know, various CDOs on the show, and I've still not had like a comprehensive vision that seems to be as solid as what I've read about with Black Swan and your kind of approach to, you know, solving some of the problems, within people taking on board data and actually getting value out of it.
Oh, that's really nice for you to say.
Yeah, so I was really just hoping, like, as far as getting started with Black Swan, like, what was there kind of a consistency with the vision about how you wanted to approach and solve some of these problems? Or, you know, has it been something that has kind of evolved over the years?
Yes, and that's the million-dollar question. And it usually depends who's asking. If an investor asks, strategically vision all wrapped up from day one. In reality, it's nothing like that. But I think the name Black Swan actually comes from a saying in London in the 16th century, where we used to say, you know, that's about as likely as seeing a black swan, Governor, right, as we sort of sit and drink gin in the London kind of bars around the capital, because there was no such thing as a black swan. You know, the swan was always white. It's a queen's animal. You know, and even now you can actually get put in the tower if you attack a swan. So just the thought of there being a black swan was just so foreign, you know, to as in the UK, that it was just impossible to think. And then we went out to Australia, to Perth actually, and in the 16th century, and we saw all these black swans. And that was really the idea, literally in the pub. You know, I founded it with another chap called Hugo Amos, and we sat there and we were like, that's just so cool that there's data out there that, you know, makes people look at things completely differently. And like, wouldn't it be cool if that's what we did? If we went and found and used data in a way that it completely changed people's perspectives. But that was it. Right. That's actually as far as the strategy got on the fourth pint. And really then from there, you know, we went about sort of just solving individual problems, but with that as our, you know, that as our USP, the thing that we became, we always thought about, you know, we only ever did work where we felt data was bringing something different to the party. And we didn't really have much of a strategy. We just kind of bumped around doing, you know, quite hard problems for our customers. So I've been immensely blessed by having people much cleverer than me who work with me. And we've just been able to solve problems using data by just really thinking about the problem we're trying to solve. And over the last sort of 4 or 5 years, sort of scaled beyond anything we ever thought would be possible, until now, where we are sort of genuinely now a product business who are using data with our product and sort of changing the way that research and aviation work. So I wish I could say, you know, from that very first moment, we knew exactly what would happen.
Yeah.
You know, I think we always knew what we wanted to do, but we had no idea, you know, what we would be doing or what where it would take us. And I just, you know, I'm immensely lucky to have gone on this journey and sort of have the people on the way to help us through it.
I still think there was something that you said in there, though, about like actually using problems that you felt could be solved, you know, by applying data. I take a lot from that, because I think one of the more common mistakes that we're in the world of at the moment is that there's a lot of hype been built up around building out data teams. And I think there's a lot of executives that are probably guilty of investing in it without really knowing like what your end goal is. And you see that kind of time and time again. And I don't think that it's always a data problem, but you clearly had that awareness and, you know, only wanted to work on projects where you believed that there was actually value in applying these principles.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, the important thing you said there is, in kind of boring terms, the way we look at it is a lot of our customers sort of dove into building these amazing data science teams without use cases. And really, you know, what makes this job really cool are the problems you solve, not the technology which does it. I mean, the technology is cool to people like me, but in reality, you know, what is worthwhile going down the pub and talking about is solving something that's really difficult and people couldn't work out by just finding different data and using it, you know, using AI or some unique way just to completely get a different result. And I think what we did learn reasonably early was the power of saying no to things which, you know, weren't to our core, and that kind of helped us get a little bit of a reputation well before we actually deserved it, I'd imagine, you know, just being the people who can, you know, find and use data in ways to solve problems that no one else could. And that really probably only came from 3 or 4 no decisions, you know, in the last couple of years, in order to get us to the kind of the core of what you were. But yeah, the key thing for us always has been, and I think the key thing for everyone who succeeds in this, is just really understanding the problem you're trying to solve and not just going, brilliant, you know, we're going to build a data science team. Because, you know, unless you know what the problems are you're trying to solve, these poor guys are going to be bored out of their mind. You know, it's just an open brief that you can't answer it.
Yeah. I mean, the like say, and it's simple but effective, isn't it? You know, it's actually saying no sometimes to situations can be more powerful than, you know, saying yes. And I think this is kind of almost the prime example of that. You know, I've even had it in my field. You know, obviously I'm a marketing director now, but, you know, you apply, everyone is looking for that silver bullet. You know, there's so much material and content out there around, you know, how to use certain, you know, data to enhance your marketing strategies, or, you know, you need to use this kind of methodology in order to generate leads, whatever the kind of bottom line is. And the reality of the situation is that every user case is totally different. You can be in the same company, the same industry, you know, looking at the same demographics as your customer, and yet it may be completely different, like the problem that you're trying to solve. And I think that's the nice, the exciting thing, but also the problem that a lot of people run into is that they're constantly looking for a silver bullet. And I think data is, for me, one of the key industries where that is more obvious than perhaps in others at the moment.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think one of the other things which we really suffer from in our industry is, you know, well, the head of data science says this to me a lot, which is, you know, to do data science, you need data. And very often, you know, we expect to do magic without having, you know, our IT set up correct, without having the correct licenses, you know, without having, you know, access to robust, quick, easy to use data that doesn't need years and years and years of cleaning just to make it useful to do the thing you want to do. So, yeah, I think mixed with a little bit of kind of, you are right that every problem is beautifully, uniquely different, you know, along with the fact that actually the IT problem needs to be solved before the data problem can be, you know, truly, truly solved, you know, does leave a lot of disappointed people.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's been a consistent issue. I think, I can't remember the stats. I did say this in a previous podcast when I had just read the numbers, but it was quite significant, the amount of I think they framed it as like executives or, you know, yeah, senior leadership teams who had, whoever was the decision maker in investing in data teams, that like there was a significant percentage of those people were reporting that they didn't feel they'd received an ROI on their spend.
Yeah.
And I don't think they knew what they were looking for in the first place, right? And I can't imagine even to this point that that's actually changed that much. And I think the example you used about the data scientist, your head of data science, yeah, people were looking, you know, in data science for whatever has picked up this kind of buzzworthy momentum. Yeah. When people probably just need like a BA or something to come in. You know, yes. You don't actually need a data scientist yet, but data scientists are being hired in just bizarre scenarios. And I can't imagine that that's changed much over the last 12 months. But it is something that, you know, clearly needs to build up some momentum in the messaging that's being put out there.
I'd 100% agree. I mean, one of the big problems I think we have in producing data problems, and not problems, but, you know, the thing which I think a lot of us miss is really that the shape of a let's call it a data science project, you know, shape of a data science project is actually very different from that of a technical build, which we're normally used to, and we do tend to treat them in the same way we would. So sort of as an example, you know, we either pick an agile process, you know, and we go, brilliant, we're going to chip away at this, and Kaizen, you know, deliberate continuous improvement head towards our main direction. And then we have waterfall, which is a, you know, much more philosophical, you know, we're going to actually plan this problem from end to end before we attack it. And, you know, we end up in a mix of the two most of the time when we're doing software projects. In data, none of those really work. You know, if you do agile data projects, you just mither around for years and years, burning, you know, a retained resource doing, you know, not really achieving much. And if you try and do it through a waterfall process, you know, you don't really know what you're looking for until you start looking. So you kind of end up with this huge, we're going to build the world's biggest unified data database, and it's going to cost us 20 million, and we're going to forget halfway through why we're doing it and fire everyone. So data projects require something a bit different. I mean, we're a big fan of Bohm spiral, which effectively is saying, you know, do a very small loop, like a snail spiral. You know, you start at the inside doing a really small loop of, hey, what are we trying to achieve? Can I quickly grab the data? You know, can we hack something together with a couple of tech guys and a data scientist to see if we can make a model that stands up historically? And then if that works, you then move to the next step, which is like, okay, well, we know we can do that. Now, can we truly predict forward? You know, can we measure ourselves predicting forward? And can we put some of the plumbing in place to mean that we can make this operational? And the third cycle is, right, we kind of know what we're doing then, and what the data we need and how we get it, and who, you know, who's going to be involved in these things, so we can actually build the platform out and make it useful, which is neither agile or waterfall. You know, it's something else completely. And, you know, we do see a lot of people trying to retrofit their software engineering processes onto, you know, data science problems and struggling a little bit.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a problem. I sent, again, I'm certainly not qualified to comment, but certainly people on the show have expressed like very similar, you know, concerns to that. You know, solving some of these problems with data, you know, obviously technology has been kind of significant. But from my, and this probably will sound layman, but from my sort of layman's perspective, and as you kind of pointed out as well with the, you know, the technology is cool, but is that really necessarily solving the problem? You know, how much more can we rely on the technology to kind of actually solve some of the problems for us with data? Because at the end of the day, to me, it still seems like, you know, humans are inputting data. And with that, there's always going to be, you know, margin for error. Therefore, you know, is it wise to rely on data, you know, to 100% of the problem? Or is it still that kind of rule of like 80, you know, but based decisions based off 80% of the data? I mean, so might sound ridiculous, but, you know, has technology kind of got to the point now where it has alleviated the human error component? Or are we still relying on humans to be inputting data from the very beginning in order to kind of actually extract the value? You know, how significant is technology in the grand scheme of things?
Well, it's not a ridiculous question. I'd say that's the number one thing we talk about in Black Swan. If you think of the word IT, you know, information technology, it's two things. It's information, data, and technology, software engineering. And the two can't really exist without each other, you know, in a meaningful, useful way. My easiest example for this is we do a lot of work in the aviation industry. And something that would shock a lot of people is that, you know, we waste up to 60% of the food we put on a plane. You know, which is really shocking when you think we fly it across the world at 40,000 feet, you know, burning fuel, burning the environment, you know, no one can get the food they want, and yet we're still throwing away 40% of it at the end of, you know, a selection of flights. But it's a really interesting problem. So when this problem came to Black Swan about 18 months ago, we used a lot of AI techniques, because what we realized is, you know, what was happening was we haven't got very good data. You know, a sandwich may get on from London Heathrow to Malaga, but then it may then pop over to Edinburgh, and then it may, you know, it could do so many different things that it was being very difficult against normal retail, you know, to try and work out what stock you need to put on for, you know, a three-legged journey, a four-legged journey. But interestingly, that turned out not to be the problem at all. The biggest problem was that what you're actually doing is, because aeroplanes weren't connected to the internet at all, you'd be asking an air steward or an air stewardess at the end of a journey to quickly write down, you know, how many beef sandwiches they had left. Right. Now, the human is in no way going to want to have run out of beef sandwiches in the next route, because that would be a nightmare. There's nothing more embarrassing than, you know, serving another human being and saying we're out of stock or something. So they lie. You know, they'll say, look, you know, we've got none of this left, even when there's four or five of them, to make sure they're overstocked and they don't ever become understocked.
Right.
And that was a real kind of lesson, because we've now got connectivity on aircraft. So now we actually have, you know, a good way of offloading from the plane how many sandwiches were actually sold, who bought them, why they bought them. It's, you know, much more like a modern retail environment. And now we have that fast flow of data. You know, we don't even need the AI anymore looking for patterns. You know, and it was very much to do with the way that, you know, the interaction between humans, you know, data and technology all takes place, to what level of data science and you know, you need to get to. So it's often quite a, you know, the relationship between data and the technology and the people is immensely complicated. And, you know, if you can't do the information or you know, if you can't do the technology and the people match, you have to overwork on the data. And if you've got the technology and the people stuff sorted, actually the data's very easy. You know, you can predict anything with the right kind of infrastructure and the, you know, the right kind of data asset. So it's a really interesting question. It's one we hit every day. You know, we'll fix something and then we'll rebuild it and then not need the stuff we needed to fix it in the first place.
I can imagine those problems make you become a bit of a cynic about people and how reliable it is.
Well, I'm also a background of psychology, so I'm a little bit sympathetic, and I'm a bit of an idiot myself too. So, you know, always
sympathetic. Yeah, it's super fascinating. I find it really interesting as well. Just like I say, trying to put together data and make sense out of like our habits in our own business, and it's a problem that's probably above far exceeds my brain. But I think it must be fascinating at the same time to be solving and working on these kind of problems. How involved are you kind of these days with some of the problems? Can you kind of pick and choose which problems you work on, or is it not as much anymore?
It's the most exciting job in the world. And, you know, we get to pick and choose. We're very blessed in Black Swan to have, you know, some amazing business analysts, data scientists, technologists who look at these problems and can, you know, look at them in a much more granular and efficient and cleverer way than I can. But I still personally get very, very involved in thinking about solutions, you know, from a high level. You know, where could we, you know, what kind of data could we source to make this prediction a little bit better? You know, and what circumstances could we not do this, and you know, how can we copy this from one country to another, you know, without having to avoid data laws, or you know, just using a proxy of our data set. You know, there are so many. It's like a huge game of chess, mm-hmm. which, you know, in multi dimensions, which you play every single day. I don't get to, unfortunately, move a lot of the pieces around anymore, but I think about the chess game all the time. And you know, I'm blessed to have probably, I'd imagine, the most fun job in the world. Every day I'll have four or five really impossible problems I get to, you know, have a go at with a load of really smart people. And you know, I would say categorically we solve all of them in the end.
Yeah, that is awesome. That is really cool. Did you, were you Did you have background in data at all before you founded Black Swan?
So that's a good question. So I'm now 44, so I went to university in 1998 or something like that. I did a course in artificial intelligence, which and it was called cognitive science. So psychology, artificial intelligence, mathematics, and philosophy. So I was always, because when we talk about data, you know, you brought up a really good point earlier about the humans. Like, because humans are part of the systems we create, you know, you need to understand the psychology as much as you understand the machine part. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking in this way since I was very young. I just happened to take, you know, 10 years off to become an unsuccessful DJ, you know, end up being a really bad software engineer, you know, a failed project manager before I actually got back to what I started studying for my academy in the first place. So it was a little bit of a journey, but it was one where I guess my interest probably was peaked when I was quite young.
Yeah, it is fascinating. It's the social and the human side of it has fascinated me as well. Like my background was economics at university, and like I was always, although I didn't study it, like I kind of, I suppose I part-timed it, so I can't claim to certainly have studied it, but behavioral economics, like, was always, I found it really fascinating, and it's kind of, you know, it incorporates that psychology element. Like the bits and pieces you did with it. And, you know, there was a really successful program that under David Cameron they rolled out called the Nudge Unit in the UK. Yeah. You're probably familiar
with it. Yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah, and I would literally could talk to you all day about this. But I think the interplay between, you know, the unpredictableness of a person, you know, the psychology is really unpredictable. You can't really say how a person could go. But our systems like Nudge have proved to us that, you know, as socially, you know, so in the, you know, if you abstract and go up a little bit, as, you know, sociology wise, we're incredibly predictable. And, you know, some of the work we've been doing in Black Swan has been amazing lately by sort of analyzing social networks, you know, and just a lot of conversations, like millions and millions of conversations, in order to predict in 6 months' time what people are going to be talking about. And that is, like, for me, is just absolutely insane that, you know, we can actually know how many people are going to be talking about an ingredient or about a feature or about a phone or about something with mathematical accuracy when we're all individuals and we're all got free choice. Okay. You know, I just find the whole thing fascinating, you know, how that ladders up and, you know, how we become quite predictable in the sociology perspective.
It just adds such a variable, though, you know, with the psychology element to it. You know, everything in, you know, my field of study was a very assumptive. You know, basic economic models are assumptive that, yes, people are going to behave rationally, and it's never the case. So it's, you know, well, I might be talking out of turn, but a lot of the time it doesn't seem to be. But I suppose that gets me onto the bit about the, you know, the predictions on the social trends and, like, the applied predictions work that you guys have done. You know, I'm sure I'm going to be wrong in saying that it's not predictive, but, you know, how complex are those variable problems, you know, when you look at some of the applied prediction work and the social trends prediction work that, you know, you're now working on?
It's a great question. So we, a Black Swan, you know, we cannot predict individuals and how they'll behave in the future. And I would, you know, I would challenge most people in the world to not be able to. And in fact, if anything, it kind of, I find it a little bit distasteful, a lot of these individual, you know, predictions of people and trying to influence individuals to doing particular things. I think where we find ourselves quite comfortable and quite excited is really in the trend space. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you've got masses of people, how the masses respond rather than how an individual responds is really where Black Swan is interested. And to be honest, is really the only useful place, because, you know, you can't build a marketing campaign, as you'll know, for every single person who you're selling to market to. You know, you end up talking in segments, you end up talking in trends, you end up talking in, you know, locations. And, you know, when you're looking at that level, things are incredibly predictable. You know, it literally shocked me. I remember when we first cracked the algorithm to be able to predict sort of 9 months into the future what people would be talking about. And it really, I had a bit of a crisis of confidence, because I was like, you know, where's free will in all this? But in reality, you know, when you think about it, you know, as a group, we've always been predictable. You know, groups of people are always much more predictable than individuals. And then when you put that, you know, hypercharge that to your millions, of course it's very predictable. know, it's just really the, it's just processes taking place. And interestingly, the theories that our data scientists use are the same theories that physicists and chemistry people use. You know, it's just all system-based theories rather than, you know, the variability of an individual atom.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And, you know, it's, do you think that with how centralized the internet has become, I find that, you know, interesting, the whole take on blockchain. I don't, won't necessarily go into that, but how they're kind of decentralized things now with blockchain. But I think the whole concept of the internet originally was that in theory it was going to be kind of a decentralized platform, right? Where, but what happened was this whole idea of a trend stands strong with your theory and the predictive work that you guys are doing, that we do kind of bunch together, you know, and that in numbers. And I think even, you know, like saying some of the great economists of our time, Alan Greenspan was even talking quite recently about, you know, what kind of state of the economy we're in now. And he very much believes that it's kind of a populist economy that we're in now. And I think it's fascinating that probably my take is that the internet has driven that quite significantly. So although like the technology is there and it is a platform, it's probably just accelerated those trends and the way that kind of humans, pursue social trends, I think.
You're right, and absolutely. It's closed the loop of information so it can cycle much faster. One of the best, you know, I don't know if you know why the marathon is a very special, you know, length. And it was back in the Roman days where the way the Romans ended up taking over most of the world is they realized that, you know, a human being could cover 26 miles in a reasonable amount of time and therefore could cover a message about a war quicker than the war could get there. So they had time to prepare for it. Mm-hmm. So what they did is they distributed their nodes, if you like, at 26 mile periods, because they realized that was the speed of information flow. And then they were able to innovate very, very quickly and, you know, outthink everyone who was attacking them because of that sort of node network. And the internet is no different. You know, the internet, all we've really done is create a communication speed and a closed loop speed that's so fast that everything in life is now speeding up because we're able to ask millions of questions where we only would have asked one. You know, being right or wrong is irrelevant when you can actually have a million goes at it.
That is fascinating. It's a great analogy as well. Interestingly enough, I'm actually going to run a marathon in April. So
I wouldn't advise that.
So it's very poignant of of my life at the moment. Yeah, I've started like month one and already have shin splints. So It's not started well at all. So I don't know whether I'd outrun the Romans, but I'm sure someone did, and gave them enough time to strategize. But I don't know whether I'd be the man you'd send out there, certainly.
Yeah, and I would be considerably behind you as well. So,
your take on this and the work, and you know, it's even obviously front and center on the like some of the banners and stuff that Black Swan have put about applied predictions. Again, was that kind of an organic thing that you ended up working on a lot of those problems, and that seems to be where kind of the demand is at the moment in the economically, that's what the clients are wanting. That seems to be the work that I suppose is in demand for you at the moment.
Yeah, we started off as an agency. So Black Swan started off as a company that's loved solving hard problems with data, which meant that we did pretty much everything. And a lot of times we would go, we could make this into a product. You know, it works really, really well. And then we'd fail. You know, we'd not put enough investment in, or it wouldn't achieve proper product market fit, or, you know, and like building a product is really, really tough. And after a kind of 4 or 5 years of failing to build products, you know, a couple of client requests came around this algorithm we'd built for predicting way into the future, and mainly around innovation and investment. Because if you truly know a product is going to be popular in 6 months, you'd invest in it. Mm-hmm. It's very simple. So what that's done now is we've actually really started the next stage of no in Black Swan, where we've started saying no to things which we normally would have done because they're bloody cool, you know, and it's really started to focus on things that are you know, to our core of our algorithms, we built around long-term prediction and really understanding the richness of what we can get from social database for things like research. So it is kind of, it's been a bit of a customer clustering conversation where lots of people are asking the same things, but then also a little bit of a, you know, an internal desire to want to be a product business. And then, you know, making some very deliberate steps this year to change our business to be, you know, to work like a product business and say no to all the, you know, a lot of the really cool projects that we probably would have done in the past.
Interesting. That is quite a significant, significant shift. So you must have confidence in your predictions tools to, that your predictions tools will be successful.
Well, we waited fortunately until some of the products we predicted were actually on shelf and selling very well. We suddenly became a lot more confident, but it was still a, you know, it's a weird thing, and you guys know because you work with, you know, talented people so much, is that actually it's a very different kind of business, a product business. It's, and in a way it's a little bit boring because you're kind of going, look, we've invented and we think we need to invent, and now we're going to scale what we have, compared to, you know, Black Swan in the past, which was like, look, we're kind of a bit freaky and weird and we can solve any problem. So it's, you know, it's a real change in the company's philosophy, which is not for some people and it is for others. You know, some people like one, some people like the other, but, you know, for us it was a challenge we couldn't really refuse. You know, we really want to make it to NASDAQ, and the way to make it to NASDAQ is to have something you can repeat again and again, you know, and you can make a good margin for it, something which no one else has. So we felt like we had all those ingredients, so, you know, we just rolled the dice.
I like it. Steve, it's fascinating talking to you, and I literally could talk with you all day, I think. So we'll leave it here for now. It's been an absolute pleasure. Hopefully we can catch up and do this again soon. But yeah, thank you so much, mate, for stopping by.
Yeah, we'd love to. And thanks very much for finding time in the podcast. I really enjoy it. So it's great to be on it.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.